Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to Raphael Baer and Caroline Crampton about whether Labour are really bashing the rich. Our editor Jason Candy talks to George and David Kinniston about their cover stories on private schools and social mobility. And I talk to feminist campaigner Caroline Criado-Perez about a change to the stalking laws. I'm joined by our political editor Raphael Baer and our web editor Caroline Crampton to talk about Labour and the economy in the wake of the 50p tax rate. So, Raph, how did that announcement play initially and how's that developed throughout the week?
Well, it obviously went down spectacularly badly with the actually not very large number of people who would be eligible to pay the top rate of tax.
Tragically, the tax ban really that newspaper editors and newspaper columnists and Tory donors fall into.
Exactly. So the short-term problem Labour has was, you know, what was exposed by this is actually the extent to which the opinion-forming class, as you might call it, is disproportionately staffed with people who, guess what, are eligible to pay the top rate of tax. And they have perfectly reasonable or just rationalised objections to it about sending the wrong signals about supporting enterprise or that it doesn't really raise a huge amount of money. I mean, it's worth adding that, the bedroom tax doesn't raise a huge amount of money, and taking away the childcare element of the working tax credit also is bad for the economy. But mysteriously, they were much more relaxed about those measures. But I'm sort of parking that for a moment.
Well, the other thing that I think gets forgotten is the fact that for 9 of the years that Margaret Thatcher was in power, the top rate of tax was 60p. And before that, it was at 88p. You know, the idea that this is some ahistorically incredibly punitive tax rate is slightly odd.
Yes, and I think the dispassionate criticism of the Labour move and the one that you get from people inside the Labour Party, a minority, but not an insignificant number, is that it falls into the category of just the sort of thing you might expect the Labour Party to do. And the problem that they have more widely in their offer on the economy is sort of grabbing people's attention, surprising them, and this is an old issue still of persuading people that they wouldn't just come in and start spending money that in most people's eyes simply isn't there. And it was notable that the other big announcement in the speech that Ed Balls made last Saturday was that he would aim to deliver a current budget surplus over the course of the next parliament, which is a major gesture towards a sort of fiscal prudence and rigour. That was a sort of allowed to run overnight in a news cycle for a few hours before being blasted off the front pages by the pledge to restore the 50p rate. And it does sort of suggest that Labour know they need to signal certain things on that front, on the fiscal discipline, but they don't want to let that sort of resonate out there for too long, because they've still got an eye on their own activists and their own left flank that go slightly berserk when it looks like they're dancing to Osborne's tune on fiscal policy.
And is that because they also want to pick up disaffected lefty Lib Dems?
Absolutely. And also, I mean, but also ordinary people. I mean, this is the important thing here, that, you know, two-thirds roughly of the population like this tax policy. They think it is entirely fair when everyone else has taken a massive hit, that people who are earning £150,000, which is a huge amount of money. No one in this room earns more than £150,000. I doubt many people listening to this podcast earn more than £150,000. So you know what? Frankly, it's not sort of the wicked neo-Bolshevik politics of envy to say those guys can cough up too when everyone else has taken a hit. So no wonder it's popular politics. And the interesting thing is whether the Conservatives, as they did with the Labour's pledge on capping energy prices, have sort of leapt to a default position that really just puts them on the wrong side of public opinion on this, and then they complain that it's all nasty left populism. Well, you know, too bad. Sometimes political parties are going to do things that are popular. That's politics.
And Caroline, do you agree with that? Were you surprised at the Tory reaction? Was it playing into Ed Balls's kind of vicious little trap?
I wasn't surprised by it at all, and I think for the reasons that Raph has just said, that it is seen as a sort of predictable thing that, oh, well, Labour would do that, and then the Tories and the kind of business lobby would respond as they have done. But I think there is also this issue that we are, what, 15 months, roughly, from the general election, and that in the grand scheme of things, it's not that much money, either for 5p extra for people to pay, nor will it raise that much money. But we're kind of in this stagnant point in the political cycle where the tiniest blip either way creates this kind of feedback loop in the media that it's very hard for Labour to kind of broadcast over.
I think my favourite thing was, I think it was the Mail on Sunday's headline, was civil, or maybe Telegraph, was civil war in the Labour Party, which is apparently caused by Lord Miners, who's a former Labour minister and from the government of all the Tans era, who is now apparently a one-man civil war.
Yes,
there are people on the Labour side, the artists formerly known as Blairites, who now have to call themselves something else because no one wants to be known as a Blairite in the Labour Party anymore, who are genuinely nervous about this, and they do think that, as I say, it's sort of a piece with a general perception that Labour doesn't really know how to go about the business of solving the deficit, doesn't really have a story to tell about how it delivers long-term prosperity, but it sure knows how to go after rich people's money, and that's kind of what the Labour Party does. And that is, if that is all that Labour is seen to be doing, then that is a problem for the brand, I think, ultimately.
I'm interested as well, actually, in, because we know that there's a kind of coming recycle of the stuff about union funding for the Labour Party. There's a report at the moment. And as they come up to the election, is being seen as anti-business going to be a problem for Labour money-wise, do you reckon, Raph?
Well, ultimately, in terms of the next general election, the money's coming from the trade unions to fight that campaign. That's clear. And that will be part of the negotiations over union reform. Is it a wider problem? I mean, someone on the shadow cabinet recently said to me that Labour's relations with business are now about as bad as they were in the middle of the 1980s, and that's not good. There are also people in the shadow cabinet who will insist that actually they can have a good working relationship with business. It's just that no one wants to come out now because people like to be seen as non-partisan. I mean, the reality is, you know, business will deal with whoever's in government. What they want is consistency, and they recognise that politics is politics. I mean, there are a lot of business people who very much don't want Britain to leave the European Union, don't even think there should be a referendum on Britain's membership of the European Union, and think all the government's rhetoric on immigration is reactionary, illiberal and unhelpful. But you don't notice them writing letters to the Telegraph saying, hey, Cameron, stop it with this mad UKIP-chasing mania. So ultimately, business will sort of go with the flow and try and influence in whatever ways it sees
that's
appropriate.
Part of the reaction that I found really interesting, actually, is that it immediately was set up as it's Labour versus business, not Labour saying something that's a little bit unpopular, but if it should happen to come to pass, business will just get on with it.
And there are lots of business people who run small businesses, run their own enterprises, who simply don't pay themselves £150,000 a year.
No, exactly, so it's irrelevant, yes.
But I thought it was really fascinating if you looked at, you're talking about that EU point, the CBI said 8 out of 10 of their members don't want to leave the EU. They don't want, again, that's why the idea, even don't want a referendum, because it creates this incredible tide of uncertainty about the single market. The same thing Stuart Rose said about migration. You know, they rely on migrant workers to in order to fuel their business growth. So why aren't Labour ever successfully landing that hit?
That's a very good question. I mean, I've asked lots of people in the Labour Party, why is it that when they've got in theory, a story to tell about a new economic model that's very optimistic and about responsible capitalism being open to the world, but also looking after, you know, boosting productivity by having happy, well-remunerated workers. Why can't they find some responsible capitalists, put them on a platform with Ed Miliband with his arm around them, and go, "This is what I'm talking about," and the answer is that I'd get is that, well, the official line is, you know, well, obviously, you know, it's in between. The election's coming in a year, people don't want to be seen to be too partisan about it. I think the reality is they are struggling to find those people, and whether that's because not enough effort has gone in or because people really are still just a bit suspicious of the Ed Miliband proposition and don't necessarily want to hitch themselves to his wagon until they're pretty confident that the guy's going to end up being Prime Minister. I'm not sure.
Which is odd, because I think in Chikramuna they've got a business secretary, shadow business secretary, who is plausible, who can, you know, he's a former lawyer at Clifford Chance, he can certainly go out and talk in the language that business leaders understand.
And he does that, and Ed Ball still is important as a sort of an ambassador to planet proper capitalism. Liam Byrne now is in the, you know, shadow biz department looking at sort of skills and enterprise, and has a remit also to make sure that there are some business people who recognise that Labour still has, you know, cares what they think and cares about supporting them. But as I say, it's sort of in the graphic equaliser of Labour's message, the bits that always get the dials...
I think that's the most tendentious metaphor, yeah.
The dial always gets jacked up.
Right,
it's
okay.
It's the one that does this, the sort of annoyed the notes on bashing business.
You're going to have to go away. I'm going to have to go and look at the Wikipedia page for graphic equaliser and find out how it works. So on that note, we'll probably say thank you, Raph and Caroline.
Hello, I'm Jason Cowley, editor of The New Statesman. This week's cover story, we're calling it the 7% problem. Why does the private school minority still dominate public life? And it's by David Kynaston, the renowned historian, and George Kynaston, a former teacher. One of the themes of the essay, David, is the silence of the left when it comes to addressing the dominance of those educated at private school in public life.
The left has been largely silent on the issue. It's starting to change, I think, but there was a long period, the first 8 or 9 years, say, of New Labour in power, when there seemed to be barely a squeak from the left over the larger issue of private education. There was a little bit over the question of charitable status, but in terms of the bigger picture, really not very much, certainly from the Labour Party. But it's broader than just Labour. It's to do also, I think, with the left-leaning liberal intelligentsia, perhaps more generally. And two things perhaps particular at play that don't often get written about. One, I think, that often is that emotional commitment to state education, particularly from people who themselves were state educated, and the feeling that if one bangs on about the private school problem and the dominance of private educated people in public life and so on, that is implicitly to denigrate the state system. I think it's a shame. It's an understandable perception, reluctance, but I think it's a shame, because I think the two sectors, the private sector does directly impinge upon the state sector. So there's that in play, I think. And the other thing, which is seldom said, and I think needs to be said rather loudly, actually, is that we are in a very London-dominated culture as far as the media is concerned. There's been some interesting correspondence in The Guardian earlier this week about it. The Guardian, the feeling among some people that The Guardian has completely moved away, as it were, from its Manchester and provincial roots and so on. And the fact is that many left-leaning intelligentsia people in London do, often for understandable reasons, send their children to private schools, and as a result feel neutered on the issue and unable to raise it for fear of being called hypocrites in particular. And if one's curious, one can go on YouTube and see the ongoing spats over the years between Toby Young and Polly Toynbee.
So there's a sense, David, of unease, yes, embarrassment even,
yes,
about their own education. There's
that too. And of course, there's some larger considerations. There's always the accusation of being accused of social engineering, which is a favourite from the right over this issue. Although it seems to me that if you choose to spend money to give your child what almost certainly will be an advantage in life, if that isn't socioeconomic engineering, I'm not sure what is. And indeed, the USP, as it were, of private schools is, in effect, we give your children an advantage. It is blatant social engineering. So that particular phrase is irritating, but it's one to which is always used by the right against the left in this argument. There's, of course, the obvious libertarian point. A parent is free to choose to spend their money how they choose to.
Yes, and indeed, in your essay, and I'll come to you in a moment, George, as someone who's taught recently in a state school. But David, in the essay, you don't call for abolition of fee-paying private schools, but at the same time you say this is a moment of opportunity, not only for the left, but for all of us.
I think it is. I think they're starting to build up a critical mass of interest in this issue. It's very interesting, in the late 50s, when Labour was thinking about its education policy ahead of the 1959 election, it commissioned a poll, including of working class parents, who simply weren't that fussed about the issue of private education, gave the impression that if they ever came into some money, they sent their own children to private schools, and believed it was simply rather odd for a party to get preoccupied with the issue. I think things are changing. I think education is moving more centre stage in all sorts of ways. And the very starting point for our essay is that actually it seems to be the right who's talking about education. We quote John Major, we quote Cameron himself, we even quote Nigel Farage, which is making the silence of the left on this, in terms of constructive proposals, all the more pointed. As for abolition, As George said on the radio this morning, this isn't where one would start from, the system we have now, but one does have to be realistic and see where we are. One thing I think I would like to say about this is that one could argue that ultimately the problem is not with the schools themselves, many of which are fine schools, many of which provide a superb education. The problem is with the children they're educating, in the sense that these are the great majority of them are already privileged children in terms of their background, in terms of their cultural, social capital, and so on. And that privilege is then drastically further entrenched and enhanced by them going to private schools. So, that is, I think, one helpful way of looking at the question: who should these private schools be educating? And obviously, I'm not the first person to come up with this point. And going back to the 1940s, there was the so-called Flemingism, a Fleming committee during the war, which suggested 25%, up to 25% in some schools, coming from outside.
So you'd open it up.
And Anthony Seldon, from within the independent sector, has also proposed that, and he would open it up not on a kind of like a kind of grammar school 11 plus basis, but on an across the board basis. So it wasn't just middle, already quite well off middle class children and so on. And I actually think that does have some mileage to it. Whether it's compatible with the other constructive approach, as opposed to the bulldozer approach of more integration between the two systems, I'm not sure. But I think our larger point, before perhaps we come to George and some more specifics of the current debate, is the really important point, and why we really wrote the article, is let's get this whole issue out on the table, and let's get the politicians talking about it properly. And in my view, that should include Labour's shadow education secretary, because if he's not talking about this issue, we're it's a pretty poor state of affairs.
George, you've recently taught in a comprehensive?
Yeah, a secondary comprehensive in Birmingham.
And you co-authored this, what is a superb and wide-ranging essay, and as editor of The Statesman, I get a lot of pitches on education. I see a lot of pieces, and this is one of the best pieces I've read on education in many years. Do you have solutions to this problem, George, or is it more of a case of just opening it up for discussion?
Definitely that is right, that the bigger picture is the kind of acknowledgement that this is a problem, that the private sector as good as it may be on its own terms, within its own four walls, as it were, does not operate in isolation. It does have a direct impact upon the state sector and upon everybody, really. You've got two competing principles in play. One is the principle, the libertarian principle.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That as a consumer, you can spend your money how you want, and as a parent, you can educate your child how you want. So you've got that on the one hand. On the other hand, the principle that every child should have an even start, that no child has earned the money that pays for private education, that no child has earned the right to a better shot. And those principles are currently pretty firmly in tension, and currently we say, well, you can spend your money, and it doesn't matter, that that completely skews the playing field. So step one is the fact that it is a problem, it should be on the table, it should be debated, and that Labour, frankly, should stop being scared of the issue and engage constructively.
Why is it that the right, Gove, Toby Young and others feel confident about speaking about these issues? You mentioned even John Major, former Prime Minister, and Nigel Farage. Mm-hmm. Why is the right emboldened and the left so timid?
It's a really good question. You could take the very cynical view of kind of, you know, wanting surface change, wanting to neuter the issue. You know, Cameron's background is not something that works well for him politically, not something he's comfortable talking about. You could take a very cynical view. I think that would be wrong. I think there is a genuine belief that this is a problem. I think Cameron in September 2011 summoned a lot of the private school heads to Downing Street. I mean, that's a genuine attempt at something constructive. I think when Gove talks about this, he means it. I certainly feel
that about Gove, yeah. Actually.
He genuinely feels that social mobility is the kind of order of the day. I think he really believes in this stuff. So I think the right is with good intentions. With the left, one, it is complicated as an issue. It is not an easy argument to kind of make or to win. Certainly if you actually get into things beyond abolition, it gets quite complicated, really. It's not something you can pitch in 30 seconds and expect to clean up electorally. But I think it's kind of discomfort, and I think it's a failure of nerve. And also, you might argue, a failure of imagination as well, that this could be part of a broader narrative about a more equal society.
I think also there's this, the 1945 myth is rather compelling. There's a sort of view we've certainly heard that we had a moment in 1945. It was a unique moment, but perhaps because Clement Attlee was an old Hayley Bjorn, or for whatever mixture of reasons, it didn't happen. That was the golden moment. It's never going to come round again.
Or was it that they felt they had greater priorities in 45 rather than
this came up this morning.
NHS, welfare system.
I think that post-war
recovery.
There were some very serious stuff for that government to deal with, and in many ways it was an amazing government. I think actually, even if it had been, as it were, higher on the agenda, Attlee, who could be a very stubborn man, was a very proud old Hayley Bjorn. he wasn't going to go there.
But it's definitely a question that's relevant right now. You're talking about a serious debate, a huge investment of political capital, if you like. I mean, you know, I suppose politicians ask the question, is it worth it, in a sense? Is it worth
the dust? The argument from Gove and the right will be, well, leave the private schools alone. These are world-class institutions. And some of the greatest success stories in British culture at the moment. Leave them alone. Let's transform and improve the state schools through the introduction of academies, free schools,
and so on.
But
it's a very, very old argument. And we, you know,
it's a code for let's not talk about it. It's a code for let's do nothing. Yes. You could make the state school unbelievably good, and still there would be the desire to not touch the private sector. Because if it still confers an advantage, people are still going to pay
well,
their money.
Well, your essay has begun a conversation which will continue. Thank you both, David Kinston and George Kinston.
I'm joined by feminist campaigner Caroline Criado-Perez, and we're going to talk about, guess what, feminism. I'm going to start off by asking you about changes to stalking and domestic violence laws, which I know that you've been involved with. What's wrong with the law as it stands?
Well, there's a few things that are wrong with the law. I mean, for a start, we don't have a law that directly targets domestic violence. And that's a problem for two reasons. First of all, it doesn't allow, therefore, for the pattern of behaviour to be picked up, which is such a huge part of domestic violence. So domestic violence currently gets prosecuted under things like kidnapping, burglary, battery, all these kinds of single incident things. And often it will be an incident that perhaps on its own isn't really big enough to get the kind of prosecution that you need. But when you compare it to, you know, when you look at it as a sort of campaign of terror, really, which is what it is for most victims, then, you know, it all adds up into something much bigger and much more important. And also the other thing is, of course, in relation to that, is the psychological element of domestic violence, which actually a lot of the victims say is the worst part. I mean, you know,
which I think is very hard for people on the outside to understand, because there is a feeling that obviously you would imagine that being hit is far worse than being psychologically controlled. But in one sense, I guess the bruises heal, but the fact that you are psychologically damaged is something that stays with you for years afterwards.
I think it's an incredibly bizarre and juvenile attitude as a society that we've chosen to take. We're reducing it all to the playground. Not that I'm suggesting that psychological trauma in the playground isn't important. Of course it is, and it can last with people for a lifetime. But we have this bizarre attitude that because we have this playtime song, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me, that therefore that is true, and actually it's complete rubbish. Sticks and stones may break your bones will heal, but your psychologically, your mind, you may never be free of them. And there are a lot of women that I've spoken to, and they sort of say, you know, 4 or 5 years later, they still find themselves looking over their shoulder, or in fact, they might still be being stalked by an ex-partner 5 years later, because these people can be incredibly obsessive, and they don't just sort of let up. And that constant feeling of fear is something I think is really hard to shake off. There's a fantastic play, actually, by a woman called Claire Moore, who runs this the Certain Curtain Theatre Company. Anyway, it's about domestic violence, and it's specifically focused on this idea of this psychological jail that you're in. And it's really trying to address the question that a lot of victims get asked, or gets asked about victims, is why didn't she leave? Because from the outside, you look at it and just think, well, he's beating her, he's denying her money, he's calling her horrible names all the time, why doesn't she just walk out? And, you know, the answer to that question is because she can't, because she's been ground down so much, and often she has nowhere to go, and she's just too scared of what will happen if she leaves. So I think, really, for me, that's one of the big reasons that I want to address this, because I really want us to start having a grown-up debate in this society about the fact that just because it's on the inside of your head and you can't see an external scar, it doesn't mean that it's not hugely important and, in fact, can take over someone's life.
And this is something, I guess, that applies to your own case and the abuse on Twitter, is that the classic comeback being, it's just words on a screen, mm-hmm. no one was ever going to act on these threats. And even taking aside the fact that, obviously, as a recipient, you absolutely have no idea whether or not people are going to act on these threats, it's hard to make people understand that in some ways the threat itself is violence, because it is designed to make you feel unsafe. In the same way that street harassment isn't just someone giving you a lovely compliment about your legs, it's designed to draw attention, make you feel nervous in public space.
And I, you know, those the experience over the summer of the abuse was just absolutely horrendous and terrifying and hugely scarring. And I mean, it has completely changed me as a person, and I really resent that. Every single day I resent how much it's changed me, and how timid and scared and sort of over-emotional and all these things that I don't want to be and that prevent me from being an effective campaigner, all these things that it's made me.
But are you reassured by the fact that, you know, you've had, you and I spoke on a panel with the MP Stella Creasy when she was at the Shadow Home Office, talking about maybe we would move around to having more of an idea about the impact on a victim. She made a very good comparison about being sent a bunch of flowers, for example, to your home address, which seems on the outside like a lovely gesture. If it's your ex who's got a restraining order out on you and it's his way of letting you know that he knows where you live, that should be read completely differently. It's obviously very hard for the law to take that into account. Is there anything else that the justice system or the media can do more in terms of being able to communicate how victims feel, how this makes victims feel?
Well, I suppose they could start by listening to victims more and broadcasting victims' voices more. I think that that's actually a huge problem, particularly in the criminal justice system, is it just feels like victims are completely irrelevant, and in many cases they just become relegated to the position of witness to their own abuse, rather than feeling that someone is actually validating their experience. I mean, when I think about the experience I've had with the criminal justice system, and what I really, really wasn't expecting, actually, was just the sense of huge relief when I read the judge's remarks about his understanding how the abuse had made me feel, and that all the way through this, I had felt continually that people weren't understanding, that I wasn't being believed, that I was continually having to justify why every time I spoke about it, it made me cry, and every time I thought about it, I felt sick, and that I could still see everything imprinted in my head. And just having someone write in black and white that this was a crime, it was a serious one, we understand the psychological impact, that makes such a difference to victims. And I think that is something that just gets missed a lot, is the importance of having your experience validated. Because so often as a victim, particularly one of a misogynistic, sexually violent crime against women, really, it does feel really stacked against you because of this perpetual feeling as a woman, but particularly in this culture that we live in of not believing women about sexual crimes and sexual slights.
I think that what your case made me understand was that if somebody with, you know, the advantages that you have had that trouble being believed, then how much more I'm worried am I about the way that the justice system treats, for example, child victims. Mm. Or victims of historic sex abuse, you know, men who are victims of sexual assault, I know, have their own kind of particular feelings of shame often about that, because it's, you know, they think someone like me shouldn't be mm-hmm. a victim. And I think I agree with you that something like Mumsnet's campaign, you know, the I Believe Her campaign, was really important for that reason, this idea that there should be a presumption of, I will hear you make your case, I will not instantly dismiss you because I instantly dismissed allegations like this. But to move on to more widely to talking about feminism, I wanted to talk to you about the idea of representation in the media, because it's something that, you know, you talk about a lot on Twitter, I talk about a lot on Twitter. It's always, there's a slight undertone of it's not a really big issue. Why are you complaining about, you know, there only being one woman nominated for this Oscar or that Oscar when there's, you know, there's other things going on? Why do you think the representation of women in the media matters?
Because media is really our prime public space. I mean, you can go and stand on Speaker's Corner, but it's not really going to have this massive impact on society. And there is still this sense that women don't belong in the public space, and you can see that because every single time a woman steps into it and speaks up, she gets hit with a torrent of abuse. So for that reason, the fact that a certain sector of society find it really troubling and challenging, that's one of the reasons I think it's really important, because until it stops being this scary, bizarre thing that we need to somehow stamp out, it demonstrates how important it is to a lot of sexist people. I think the other reason, though, is that the media in particular set the terms of debate, and they have a huge impact on, you know, what we consider to be an important topic. And you just have to look at the type of coverage that we have in most newspapers and what it's about. So, for example, I think it's 78% of lead stories are written by men, and 84% are about men or have men as the prime topic. And if our focus as a society is to such a huge extent about men, rather than about women, who are, after all, 50% of the population.
51%, then.
Sorry, apologies, 51% of the population. You know, that's massively skewing what we consider to be important topics and what therefore politicians are thinking about when they're forming policies. So it's not really, I think people make the mistake of, when people talk about representation, of thinking we're just thinking about that woman who's going to be on that panel, or that woman who's going to get the Oscar, or that woman who's going to be the subject of this newspaper article, or that woman who's going to write the newspaper article. It's not at all. It's about setting the terms of debate, which affects all women. So, for example, things like forced marriage and FGM, which are always the things that get thrown at, you know, privileged feminists, that you're not talking about this enough, you only care about, you know, your newspaper column. Actually, having more women making these decisions, making these policies, writing these articles, inevitably means that you have more of a female perspective, more female issues are spoken about, and therefore things start to change for all women.
I have to say, I have a personal animus against, I tweeted this about I often find that whatever you write about and it's a feminist subject that's not FGM, you have FGM thrown at you. Why aren't you talking about FGM? Bizarrely, when you know, we've had Nim Karali on this podcast before, and Leila Hussein, also Daughters of Eve, which is a fantastic anti-FGM campaigning organisation. Mysteriously, when you do talk about that, the tumbleweed rolls across your feed. And it does seem to exist in this sort of strange kind of space that it's used as a rebuke, but it's not deemed to be interesting as itself. And that really annoys me because FGM is such an important
issue. Well, exactly. It's used as a stick to beat feminists when actually we should just be talking about it and trying to deal with it. Because, you know, so often it's just become a meme in a way, which is incredibly troubling for something that's so important.
Yeah, it's become what kind of the war in Iraq was to Guardian comment boards in the 2000s. It was like, whatever the Guardian article was, it was always, why are you talking about this when we're at war in Iraq? Which is, you know, often a very valid point, but it doesn't really ever advance the debate about either of the topics at hand. Finally, as your campaign to get a woman on the banknote ended up with Jane Austen getting on the banknote, favourite character in Pride and Prejudice?
favourite character in Pride and Prejudice? Well,
I'm going to go Mr. Bennet. I know, I've got a big love for Lizzie, but
Mr. Bennet?
It's got to be Mr.
Interesting.
Bennet.
Interesting.
If any young gentlemen come for Kitty or Lydia, tell them I am quite at leisure.
I would probably go for Lizzie, just because, you know, Mr. Bennet, while I do love him, he is sexist towards his wife. And I can't really forgive him for that, because obviously Mrs. Bennet is awful, but she's a product of her time. And that's really what I really love about Austen, why I get so angry when people denigrate her and just call her chick lit and she's just about rich women finding rich husbands. No, she isn't. You know, she's a hugely sensitive and nuanced cultural critic. And I think actually it's sexism that people don't recognise that. It's because she's a woman, and so they think, oh, well, it's just surface level, and it really is just this nice little story that it seems to be. And they completely miss all the really barbed satire that's running on underneath it, and her strong, strong critique of women's social roles. And I think Mrs. Bennet is a really interesting representation of that, because she's so much represented as completely trapped by what was expected of her and her life, and being moulded in a way by Mr. Bennet, and he sort of set her up as his antagonist, and in some ways he's almost created her.
I have great respect for your nerves. They've been my companions these 20 years at least.
Yeah.
There is a feeling that they've both got themselves into a rut where he is the nagged and she is the nagger, and
that's just, you know, isn't that, you know, women and men's roles represented at large across the media. When I look at my parents, and I grew up, you know, my mum is not like Mrs. Bennet, but there was that kind of dynamic, and I looked at them, and I didn't want to be my mum, because she was, you know, the naggy, you know, neurotic, whatever, that women are. And my dad was this really impressive and calm, and he was funny, but he would never get over emotional. And so I grew up as a girl, you know, rejecting anything that was to do with the feminine, because I looked at my dad and that's, you know, that's what you're meant to be, and that's Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Bennet. And so I can't forgive Mr. Bennet for what he did to Mrs. Bennet, I'm afraid.
It also makes me think of the really killer line in Friends, which again I will defend as a social commentary to my dying day, where Rachel, Jennifer Aniston's mum, said to her, "You didn't marry your Barry, honey, I married mine." And the whole idea that she thinks, she looks at her parents' marriage and she thinks they've had this perfect marriage, but no, her mum made the compromise that she was strong enough to reject. But had she lived at the time that her mum did and not had the pill and not had all the advantages that she had, would she have been any stronger to make that choice? On which incredibly digressive digression, I would say thank you very much, Caroline, for coming
thank
in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.